Chapter 1, The Entrepreneurial Guru. A couple of years ago, the New Yorker featured an article called The Higher Life, subtitled A Mindfulness Guru for the Tech Set. This was my introduction to Andy Puddicombe, identified as a British meditation teacher. As a young man, Puddicombe dropped out of school to train as a Tibetan Buddhist monk. He then lived in Russia, where he earned a degree in circus arts. You know, he's another one of those British Buddhist Russian circus meditation monks. The article explained that Andy Puddicombe has given up being a monk, but is continuing his work in part through the iPhone app he created called Headspace, which purports to teach meditation and mindfulness techniques. Headspace markets itself as your gym membership for the mind, promising on its website, find some extra calm and clarity with our free Take 10 program, just 10 minutes a day. It will likely not surprise you that there are detractors. Skeptics, the article explains, dismiss it as the new aromatherapy, portraying Puddicombe and his ilk as snake oil salesmen in religious robes. But it notes, Headspace has attracted a passionate fan base. One, a DJ, attests that it cured his anxiety, acclaiming, it's like having a monk in your pocket. However, the article's buzzkill came from a Buddhist scholar. The writer acknowledges many Buddhists don't love the wonder drug version of meditation. They're bothered by the way it has come to be adaptable to any goal, from training Marines to picking investments. Then the real downer. David McMahon, a Buddhist scholar, interjects that in Buddhism, mindfulness isn't actually about Silicon Valley success or stress relief for highly privileged people. You are, he claims, supposed to be mindful of something, the teachings of the Buddha. He asserts the teachings of the Buddha aren't always warm and fuzzy, nor would they play well at a corporate retreat. The most important precept, after all, is the universal truth of suffering. Chapter 2, The Tension. I have no need to referee that fight. I have no need to dismiss those whose lives are more peaceful because they have a particular iPhone app. And having studied Buddhism fairly intently for a while, I understand both the scholar's dismay and the ways his critique can itself be challenged. So I'm not taking sides. I am offering this inconsequential dispute to exemplify one of the perennial conflicts where spirituality is concerned. Rather than represent it as an either-or argument, we'd do better to imagine this tension on a spectrum, anchored by two distinct polarities. On one end is the notion of spirituality as a path to peace and inner harmony, to self-acceptance and self-affirmation, to comfort and calm and clarity. At the opposite end is the sense that a deep engagement with spirituality inevitably fosters upheaval, unsettledness, discomfort, a critique of who we are, and a challenge to change. Chapter 3, An Introduction to the Artist. The Dutch artist Piet Mondrian was born in 1872 into a Calvinist family. He determined at an early age to follow in the footsteps of an uncle who was a landscape artist, and so began painting as a young man. His initial works, some of which you've already seen in this service, were not remarkable. They depict the way he'd been taught to see the world as an artist, through the lens of a conservative Dutch landscape and still life tradition. Art was intended to represent, to show the world as it is. As such, it should prove mostly accessible and pleasing, comfortable. Chapter 4, My Spiritual Practice. Over the years, I've developed my own intentional spiritual practice. Reading, reflecting, sometimes writing, occasionally praying early in the morning. I would call what I do a practice or a discipline because I engage in it with regular intention, whether I actually feel like it or not. I would call what I do spiritual because I engage in it in order to connect to something sustaining, something deep and grounding that helps me make meaning and, more importantly, feel fully alive. There's no question I've imagined my particular spiritual practice as a way to calm myself, regain focus and perspective, pay attention, and to recognize and appreciate beauty. That is, I would locate my long-standing practice well to one end of the spectrum I identified, the end that has to do with comfort and calm and clarity. Chapter 5, The Artist Transforming. In his late 20s, Piet Mondrian begins presenting a different kind of art. The images are bolder, less representational. We need not look past the natural, he would write, but we should, in a sense, see through it. As he continues this shift, he begins to understand and express something much deeper. No longer is art about being accessible and attractive. Now the artist develops a sense of his work that is intended to carry a particular weight. We have, he declares, a nostalgia for the universal. This nostalgia must bring forth a completely new art. And so art, although an end in itself like religion, is, he says, the means through which we can know the universal and contemplate it. It's an audacious project. He wants to make art that fosters deep and powerful connections, that will, he says, bring our outer life into harmony with our inner life. He calls it the life of the human spirit becoming conscious. The role of the artist, he believes, is to enable us to see and appreciate life, our lives, all life, in a new way. Importantly, art should disrupt our common, predictable, comfortable ways of seeing, and in so doing, offer us something new. Some new, more vital encounter and experience. You see that You see that movement in these three images. The red tree moves away from predictable representation. Roger Lipsey, author of The Spiritual and 20th Century Art, says that this painting reveals Mondrian's questions and his search for the transcendental pattern into which all life falls. Silver tree moves further still, not looking like any tree we've ever seen. And by the time he offers apple tree in bloom, Mondrian is challenging us and unsettling us all the more. What is the message? What are we to see? How are we to experience what he is offering? It is not clear. And it will not become clear in a 10-minute app session. Chapter 6, The Spiritual and the Social. I entered college with the spiritual conviction of an evangelical. For me, that meant at least two things. One, faith was mine to work out for myself. From a young age, I'd been told, no one can decide for you. You must make your own decision. And only you can embody that decision with integrity. Just as I had a responsibility for my physical health, so too my spiritual health required my attention. But also, faith, as it was presented to me, had to do not just with the condition of our souls, but with the condition of our lives. So the people I knew in my own family and in my church believed in doing good. They contributed time and money to soup kitchens and shelters, to tutoring and encouraging, in time to Habitat and a home for single moms. There was a very strong strain of, as I often heard it said, helping the less fortunate. Our spiritual grounding insisted that we stretch our concerns beyond self-interest to include those who needed our help. Early on in my time in college, I encountered something different, challenging, troubling. Certain professors, speaking from their profound spiritual conviction, were actively protesting nuclear proliferation. They were calling into question U.S. intervention in Central America. They were critiquing our consumerist, capitalist culture and asking hard questions about why things are the way they are. I started studying liberation theology and encountered a radical spiritual tradition claiming that God was always, always on the side of the poor. God acted not by providing handouts or even a hand up, but by empowering the poor to overturn the whole social order. They appealed to the radicalism of Hebrew prophets, to the radical message of Jesus, who claimed that the poor and the peacemakers would one day inherit the earth. The deeply spiritual worldview of these liberation theologians had deeply provocative and threatening social implications. They weren't asking the privileged for crumbs off of the table. They were actively working with the poor to overturn the whole damn table. Oh, this was hard. This was a whole new way of seeing things. Something I'd never heard or seen or experienced before. This interweaving of the spiritual and the social troubled me, confused me, concerned me. It upended my world. I now recognize more clearly, I've never been completely comfortable since. Chapter 7, Always Further. Piet Mondrian, as many of you know, didn't stop with these images. He kept on with what he'd called dynamic movement in equilibrium, an equilibrium that could exist within dissonance. His art becomes completely, starkly, shockingly abstract. The abstract in art, he writes, is established by the most profound interiorization of the outward and the purest exteriorization of the inward. Art in abstraction meets at the place where the deepest connection to the universal within and the deepest connection to the universal beyond find expression. John Golding writes, Mondrian never attained the goal of the absolute, nor would he have wished to do so. His credo is encapsulated in two words he often used: always further. Through his art, he had come to realize that the only way forward was to reject every visual certainty he had reached in order to look ahead to a new and hopefully higher one. It's a deeply spiritual sense of art, a spiritual sense invested in unsettling, upsetting, undoing. It offers little comfort, not much by way of recognition, and no certainties at all. Truth, capital T, truth, would remain veiled. And yet he will continue to allow for new possibilities, for new ways of seeing. If we cannot free ourselves, he asserted, we can free our vision. Chapter 8, Spiritual Transformation and Societal Transformation. In the past few years in general, and in the past few months in particular, I have been hearing the call to a different, additional spiritual practice. This one bears little resemblance to my early morning meditation, and has more in common with what I heard from my college professors and from those liberation theologians. My spiritual practice now entails the immense risk of opening my heart, of opening my very soul to the realities of seeing the world through very different eyes. In my personal reading, in my deep pondering, in my interactions in the community, especially in some ways in our unsettled streets, my spiritual work has to do with trying to understand how my privilege shapes how I see the world. my guides, my gurus have no apps to offer. They simply trouble my perspective with stories of their experiences. Personal experiences that are so unlike my own. My work, my spiritual work has been to try as much as possible not to judge. Not to critique. Not to draw conclusions. Certainly not to condemn. It is rather to listen, to care, to be present, to keep being present. Oh, through their eyes, I can hardly recognize the world I know. And so for now, there's nothing remotely comforting or calming or clarifying. It is disruptive, which I suppose is always a necessary step on the way to transformation. If I cannot free myself, if I cannot free others, I am at it even still in the hopes that I can free my vision, my way of seeing our world. Conclusion, which is no conclusion at all. Spirituality, my friend and colleague Peter Morales claims, feels like deep peace, awareness, calm, authenticity, compassion, community, acceptance, enduring love. Spiritual practices, claims my colleague James Ishmael Ford, are not about making you feel better. They are about walking through a door from one place to another. What if they're both right? What if they're each right for certain people or at certain times? The Spanish poet Juan Ramon Jimenez urges, or maybe prays, but let the wings take root and the roots fly.